I hope that the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and the Brahmaviharas are meaningful for you. And they're not meant to be truths that you have to somehow find a way to believe, but rather as pointers that support you in trying to understand yourself better, and so you can find what's true for yourself. You don't have to give these things too much authority, only enough value that they can function as mirrors, as suggestions, as pointers. How is it for you? How does this work for you? I'm fond of bringing these two together, the Four Noble Truths and the Four Brahmaviharas. It's easy to think of the way the Four Noble Truths are traditionally or often presented. You know, they kind of focus on your inner life, your suffering, the cause of your suffering, your walking the path of practice. And the Brahmaviharas are more about the interpersonal life, how you relate to other people. But I don't see them as so separate. I see them, both of them, as being elements of the heart. They're both parts of your hearts. Both ways of understanding your hearts. And both may be two sides of the same coin. Two sides of the same hand, perhaps. I kind of find it nice that the traditional description of the Four Noble Truths has no pronouns in it. It doesn't say that, you know, your suffering or, you know, my suffering. It just says suffering. To me, I see that, and it's kind of inclusive. We notice suffering wherever we see it. We learn to open, be present for it in our lives and the lives of others. And doesn't say my cause, but we understand something about how the causes that of all this. My own journey to coming to understand or to realize the Four Noble Truths have gone hand in hand with my realizing or valuing the Brahmaviharas, the movements of the heart to love and be connected to others. And maybe it's a, you know, the very forces that keep me suffering are the forces that keep me from connecting to others in a deep way. And as I learn to connect to others in a deeper way, it's harder for me to suffer. There's more the barriers to that fall away. You know, I find that we're deeply connected to each other. It's just really phenomenal how, and I don't think I could have understood this for myself without having done Buddhist practice for years, number of years. And I was surprised how that opened up to a real sense of our tremendous interconnectedness. And it's like we're all family. And just like families are complicated, you know, we're complicated to put together, but we're all family. You know, and, you know, it's been said, it's meaningful for me personally to think that we all share the same ancestor, go back far enough. We're all related. And we say that in Buddhism, where they say, in kind of the mythological language of Buddhism, that some point in the past, we've all been each other's mothers and fathers, and brothers and sisters, and sons and daughters. Kind of points to the kind of feel interconnectedness of us all. And it's mostly, I think, because of the interconnectedness. You know, interconnectedness is not just all good news. It's kind of because of the interconnectedness that most of us end up suffering. Most of our suffering isn't just because we're sitting at home watching TV and dreaming up, you know, how's a good way to suffer? You know, then get really into it. Usually many of our sufferings have some kind of origin in what happens to us interpersonally, often growing up. You know, and I don't have a memory of this, but my father tells me that my personality changed after he hit me as a kid, when I was young. I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And when he told me that, I associated with an image of being at the beach, particular beach. What happened there? What happened when I got hit? And then I can, you know, I can go through, just like many of you do, a series of things happened to me growing up, where I shut down, I closed down, I pulled back. You know, I was ridiculed, I was chastised, and just got to, I still have memories of just like in my chest, you know, something locking up, closing, boom, I'm not going to show that to anyone again, no more of that. Pulling back. But it wasn't, you know, always so dramatic. You know, I'm also, you know, being attacked in a dark street corner, street kind of side alley when I was 14. And that kind of shaped me also. It brought a lot of fear of cities at night. Kind of years of heightened caution. I remember when I was at my middle teenage years and being left alone at home at night with my parents. Common enough thing to happen, but the legacy of being attacked was still with me. And I used to stay awake looking out the window into the yard, waiting for someone to come and attack. Just trying to be safe, trying to, you know, wanted to be vigilant and just notice and just peering out into the dark. And in some of it, you know, I didn't even know, I wasn't even suffering some of the ways the interpersonal life, you know, contributed to my, you know, my life was limited. In seventh grade, we had an assignment in class to do some art. And so I innocently and kind of happily was doing it and didn't think much about it, just doing it. And maybe just as happily, innocently, I don't know what was going on, the teacher came and looked over my shoulder and looked at what I was doing and said to me, you have no artistic ability. You know, and I didn't really care. I didn't really think that I needed to or wanted to. I wasn't part of my world at all, but this was an authority figure speaking, so it must be true. So I didn't suffer, but I just had a view of myself. You have no artistic ability. I have none at all whatsoever. That was the view. And I went along happily with that, you know, just, I didn't know that was a problem or anything, just who I was. And then freshman year in college, my roommate was an artist, and somehow he tricked me into doing art. It started off with doodling in the margins of my class notes, and it grew slowly into taking art classes and eventually becoming an art major. And it was fun. I just did it. It was nice, you know. You don't doodle for anything, you know, in your classes for anything more than maybe boredom. But you know, just what you do, you know. I don't know. Just almost don't think about it. So it was kind of like that. Did art, and it was nice. And I even became an art major, but that was mostly so I could get into the special art classes. But then there came the very special day where I decided I was an artist. And then I had to do art in order to maintain the identity. And then I couldn't do, that was like just too, that, you know, that, and so the solution, of course, then, of course, you know, I just stopped doing art. You know, so I gave it up. And so on one hand, I had this view that I was not artistic, and then I was the artist. Both ways were kind of tied me up, kind of got me caught up in ways and limited me. And then I went to the monastery. And it was great. It was great and painful to be in the monastery. But what happened in the monastery was, among other things, I started to let go a lot. I'll talk more about it maybe. Just letting go. And all these views I had about myself, what I had to do, who I had to be, kind of started to fall away. And lo and behold, art started happening again. And it just kind of happened. It was just like, it wasn't like I was trying to be an artist. I wasn't trying even to do art. Maybe if, I don't know if this, we can say, you know, the difference between, maybe between the I am breathing and I breathe, and is that I'm breathing maybe is, you know, more action. You can consciously breathe, but I breathe maybe can suggest more that it just, you know, there's no conscious effort to breathe, it just happens. So I wasn't that I was doing art, but I was arting. They're just kind of what was, you know, what was going on. It's just kind of freedom and ease and non-identification. It just kind of what's bubbling up. So the same thing happened for me with loving kindness and compassion as I practiced. That you know, I had a lot of things that, because of my conditioning growing up and all this, that a lot of reasons why I was shut down, unwilling to open up, hesitant. I had a self-image that was very dismissive of myself, because some of my so-called friends that I grew up with were very dismissive of me, and so I kind of I internalized that. And so, as I would sit day after day in monasteries, I slowly learned something about how I participated in my thinking, participated in having desires, participated in having aversions, or participating in having fear. And this was really great to see the activities that I was doing inside of me, and even saw how I was participating in keeping the walls up. And then I got to see how tiring it was. And I'm kind of a desire type person. In Buddhist, you know, personality types, I think I'm clearly a desire person. And they're like, desires are a dime a dozen for me. They come so easily. Pesky flies that are always around. But it wasn't always, I didn't always relate so lightly to my desires. And when they come, you know, you know, 60 desires a second, 60 desires a minute. I don't know, just different speeds, right? I can get up from zero to a desire in 1 second, half a second. But when they're kind of constant, it's exhausting. It's very tiring. It's a big cost to be living a world of desire. It took me a long time to see that. Because often when there's desires or we're involved in thoughts, we're often involved in the object of what we think. The story, the fantasy, the plans, the projections, and everything, what it's going to do for me. And so we don't often take that 180-degree turn and look back and see what it's like to be participating. What's it like to be desiring or being aversive, be angry? What's it like to be afraid? What's it like? Because, you know, we can so focus on what we're angry with, what we're afraid of, what we're wanting. And so, but I couldn't, you know, eventually, but just sitting and sitting and sitting with myself, I got to see how I was participating, what I was doing. And I saw the cost of it. And it wasn't all at once. Saw different things at different times. And then slowly, some of these things started to let go, soften, relax. And to my surprise, one of the consequences of that was I started feeling more and more connected to others. And the sense of compassion for others grew. First it was compassion, then it was followed by friendliness or kindness. And I tried in college a few times to be kind. And I remember once trying to be kind to a young woman in the library campus. And after I left her, even I thought, boy, that was sick. What did she think? Or I also saw what it was like not to have compassion. You know, to hold back and have judgments and ideas of people. And but as I practiced, it was the same thing with the art. You know, that it wasn't like I had to do compassion. It wasn't like someone told me, "Gil, it's a good idea to be compassionate." And but rather, it just started to grow and develop. And actually, when it first started to grow for me, I didn't know it was happening. And I would start seeing things in the environment that were compassionate, and I needed it so much. And you know, I would see certain people and think they were the embodiment of compassion. Wow. Later, I told that to some people, and they said, "You thought who?" I just thought somehow. But it was so, like, even sometimes the wind, breeze against my cheeks, I felt, oh, that's a compassionate wind. And at the Zen Center, they have at the top, in the main hallway there, they have this wooden statue that's about 5 feet tall. And it has kind of a sinuous kind of shape going up. It's like a column that kind of has an S shape, kind of goes up to a point. And it was the first thing I would see coming up the steps from meditating. And for me, that statue was the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. For years, I would go, oh, so nice to see. And then at some point or other, after many years there, someone told me, no, it's a flame. The artist, you know, if you look at it, yeah, it looks like a flame just coming up. You know, maybe because, you know, Buddhism quenches the fires of craving or something. I don't know why, but the artist had made a flame and it was put there in the very center of the building. And but that time it had already served me. So it didn't matter what it was anymore. For me, it was compassion. So this idea of seeing it elsewhere. And then slowly I began to feel it inside myself and became something that I could come out of me into the world around me. And so for today, the topic is the third noble truth, that of the cessation of suffering, This is meant to be the good news in Buddhism, except it doesn't, it's not worded like in a celebratory way, the cessation of suffering. Some people feel like, gee, that's all I get? But the cessation of suffering is the good news, and we're connecting that to equanimity, brahma-viharas, the particular form of love. And I think maybe a way of kind of getting into this topic of equanimity and connecting it to the cessation of suffering is to understand something about how the mind gets agitated and how the mind maybe doesn't have to be so agitated. Because equanimity has a lot to do with an unagitated mind. And having an unagitated mind in relationship to what goes on around us or what goes on within in us. There are different kinds of equanimity. So one equanimity is not the Brahma-Vihara type, but it's equanimity to all the mental formations, all the mental activity that goes on inside. So I could have a thought sitting here innocently and for no reason that I can be aware of, I can think about my high school girlfriend who jilted me. And so that thought can come up, and there's maybe, you know, there's different options of what happens as a result of that. One option is that I really, you know, I'm justified being angry, and, you know, and when she said that, then, you know, not only was that time, it was the other time, and boy, she really kind of screwed me, and you know, if I could see her, I'd give her a piece of my mind and tell her what it was like, and I know how she'd respond, and I know what I would do. It's been 40 years. And, you know, that's one way, you know, I'm agitated, I get involved, you know, here sitting here peacefully meditating, and now I'm in this major conflict with someone who, I don't even remember her name. Or I could see, have the thought arise, the memory arise, and just see it as a memory, and just let it be, and just it goes by. The mind doesn't have to do anything with it, unagitated. And I think that this is what happens to us, if people who do a lot of meditation, especially mindfulness meditation. It's not fast, but I suspect all of us slowly get so familiar with how our minds work and the stories we tell ourselves and the things we get hooked into and get caught in, that slowly we learn, you know, I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to get involved in that. I think I'll just let that one be. Sometimes it can happen, you get, you know, you after, you know, days of being in retreat, you're finally kind of a little bit quieter and more peaceful. It feels so good to be quiet and peaceful compared to how you started. And then you see a particular thought arise, and you know where that's going to go, and you have just enough freedom, you can say, not now, I don't need to do that. I don't have to pick that up. Let it be, because I like to stay in this peaceful place. So, you know, it might be memories from a long time ago, or the planning mind. You know, some people are experts at planning. They spend a lot of time in it, expert in terms of doing it, not in their success. Started to give up planning when it finally dawned on me, because I did a lot of it, what a very poor track record I have for predicting the future. And so many times I had predicted what it was going to be like, and I was planning what I was going to say, what I was going to do, and that the event never happened, or it was different than what I thought. I was a slow learner, but eventually it happened so often that I realize I don't have a good ability to know what's coming. So that kind of started loosening the grip and the fear that was part of that planning. So now a plan can come up, or a little idea of, you know, just it just goes through and you don't pick it up maybe, leave it alone. Or some idea of what other people will think of you. That was a real hook for me. What do other people will think about me? That would definitely make me agitated, and actually, sometimes it never made me agitated because I couldn't get more agitated. You know, I was already, you know. And so I would start, you know, if I had those kinds of thoughts too, I could, you know, just. But then to kind of have the thought, you know, what do other people think? And just kind of not get involved. Just let it be. Just let it come. Let it kind of come through the field of mindfulness. Just know it. Or to have something arise and get involved. Be aversive to it, be desirous as to get coked by it. But to have enough sense to be equanimous about that. To have enough sense to, when we get tripped up and caught up in all the stuff that we can get caught up in, to have some sense, some ability, well, maybe I can now step back and leave that alone. Not be more agitated. So the story of the arrows, right? Second and third and fourth arrows, I think. Vinny talked about the arrows, right? And so starting to see how the mind, the heart works, and to start leaving things alone. Just let them go through. Let them happen. And there's and one of the things that I've also learned through this whole process, you know, related to this, my very poor record at predicting the future. I also have a very poor record of predicting what I need. Like what needs to happen in my meditation? What needs to happen in my spiritual life, in a Buddhist practice? I had all kinds of plans, you know. I go on retreat. I know what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to work on this thing. I'm going to get this thing and that thing. And a great one is to come on retreat and I'm going to do this. I'm going to get the same experience as I had last retreat. That's what it's going to be about. All these ideas of, you know, plans around the practice. And I've learned slowly that the Dharma knows better than I do what I need, what needs to happen. So now it's not so much about getting in there to make something happen, but much more about just being again with what is and trusting. But trusting not in a way that kind of participates, but learning to just trust and be with what is and be curious and find out what wants to bubble up, what wants to come, what wants to happen. You don't know what's needed, and you don't know how these things, what's going to blossom. One of the really important insights in all this Buddhism is the practice is impermanence, the change, the changing seasons of our life. And, you know, we need all the seasons. So an apple tree might look really beautiful in the summer, green leaves and maybe beautiful red apples beginning to grow and into the fall. And then the leaves turn and they fall in the fall. And then they go through winter. And the apple trees really need to have a long, cold winter. If the winter is not, some apple varieties, if not hard winters, you know, something important doesn't happen for the apple trees. They can't blossom next year. And then after the winter, this dark time and stuff like that, cold time, then at some point, these buds break out of the trees. Spring comes. The sunlight comes. The warmth comes. And in the warmth and the sunlight, something begins to blossom. And that blossom then produces fruit. And the cycle begins again. I think our lives are like that too. Sometimes we're in the summer of our lives, you know, some past aspect of our lives, and things are just great and sunny, nice, leafed out. And then we lose our leaves. So there's a lot of loss. But things we let go of, things change. And then there's difficult days, dark times. And the difficult and the dark times don't have to be a mistake. They don't have to be limiting. They don't have to be seen as or related to as problems. It might be very important that we go through that. Sometimes maybe what we need is to have a really good chill, really good cold heart spell, You don't know what needs to blossom, what will come out of the darkness. And then we come to a time when things get warmer. Spring time becomes warmer and nicer, and we feel kind of pastoral or something nice, and we're kind of looking forward to those blossoms. And so, you know, you maybe get a little bit impatient about those blossoms, and you know there's supposed to be apple blossoms in an apple tree, and it's springtime, and it's about time they came out. And so, you know, you could, you know, take and, you know, start snapping the branches, you know, to kind of encourage or help the blossoms out. You know, they're in there, aren't they? And, you know, it's like the farmer who wants the corn plant to grow faster, so she tugs on the little seedlings and just pulls them out of the ground, you know. So, you know, there's also, you have to kind of let, you have to let the apple tree blossom in its own time and let the spring do its own magic and warmth, and something comes out. So the same thing with us. To trust the process. Who knows what's moving through you? And if you're sincere, if you're really present, sincere in being present for what is, and be willing to keep opening and opening to what is, and allowing to be there, and not be agitated by it, not be afraid of it, not be desirous of it, but just be, then you'll go through your seasons. And no matter where you are in the season, it's probably the right place for you. If it's cold spell, difficult winter storm, warm summer, shedding your leaves, the blossoming of flowers, don't expect that it has to be one way only. This is it. The only blossoms. Only that you're losing your leaves. It's all a piece coming around. And what's nice, and this is where the kind of one of the central aspects, I think, of the freedom in Buddhism, that Buddhism points to, that freedom is not found in the cycles that we find ourselves in, but freedom is found in letting the cycles move through us freely, not interfering or interrupting in them. So if we identify with any points in the different cycles where we can be at, if we identify with what our experience is, there's less freedom. And the freedom is to let it move through us, to let it come. And it's a very strange freedom for people who are looking at things in the world to provide them with satisfaction, or looking towards avoiding things that's going to make them safe. To have our desires fulfilled, if that's where our happiness lives, then we don't know about the freedom that comes just from being. So someone who really has a strong desire to be an artist, it's a fine thing, desire to have. I think it's a great thing. I wish more people had it. But to have a strong desire to be an artist could mess themselves up the same way that I messed myself up in being the artist. But I'm supposed to be someone. My parents need me to be someone. My friends won't like me, or they don't know how to relate to me unless I am someone or show myself. It's important to be someone. But the kind of art that I did coming in the monastery, I was not an artist. And I wasn't even thinking about doing it, it just kind of came. We let go of our desires, and motivations can still arise, but the motivations come from some place, just maybe the same place as that the apple blossoms come. Where do they come from? You don't see them. You can't break open the branch and find them. So, what is it that wants to come out through you if you get out of the way? So we sit. So the equanimity towards all formations, all the mental inner world, is an equanimity of not getting agitated by movements of our hearts and minds. It's okay. It's okay to have the thoughts you have, the feelings you have. It's okay. But to be unagitated, just to, it's okay, just to see it. Don't get involved. Just be. And it's such a relief to have that kind of mind that doesn't get agitated by what happens. The equanimity of the Brahmaviharas, which is a kind of love, is a love that doesn't get agitated by what goes on around. So there are times when the people we love and care for are in distress and have difficulties. And it's very easy to get agitated because of it. And some people feel justified in getting agitated or feel like it's appropriate or they need to get agitated. You know, because agitation means that you've got to do something. And how are you going to do something unless you're running around agitated? But how to love without being agitated? How to be present for someone in distress who you can't help? And this is where the love of equanimity is. You can't really help them. Or you shouldn't help them. Because they have to find it out for themselves. And so, you know, it's not, you might have a lot of compassion, but compassion usually then manifests itself as, you know, really trying to help them. But when you can't help them, you can still love them. But in loving them, can you do so without being agitated? And that's the equanimity of Brahmaviharas. So it requires learning something about how the mind gets agitated, how it gets stimulated by craving, by clinging, by wanting, by not wanting, by resisting. And, you know, and a kind of the reverse or the other side of agitation is becoming frozen. Closing down, becoming frozen, being shut down. And there is a kind of stability in being frozen. There is a kind of non-agitation in being frozen. But it's not real stability. So, and this happened to me, you know. So as I practiced, one of the surprises for me also was how much I was frozen. And how much slowly began to thaw and open up. And that opening and thawing process of my heart was not always easy. Came with a lot of tears. And was not always, you know, I didn't really know enough to trust even that process. But, you know, it just had to happen. So then, to sit and be not agitated with what is. To be able to let a thought arise, a feeling arise, an experience around us happen. And see that the mind doesn't waver, doesn't get caught, doesn't get involved in for or against. And to appreciate that this is actually a valuable thing. It's not like a neutral shutting down. It's not like a becoming less or diminishing ourselves. It's actually a way to enhance ourselves, to become bigger, stronger, to have this ability to sit there and be. And it's hard to understand that when we have a society that tells us you're supposed to do and have and get and whatever. So with this non-agitation, we can start appreciating different aspects of our life. And in particular, we begin to appreciate what it's like not to cling. What it's like not to be caught by things, involved with things. You know, I slowly learned to appreciate what it's like not to be constantly involved in my desires. Because I saw how tiring it was. And it was so much better just let a desire kind of just float by and leave it alone. What a relief. Just let it be. It was so much better to watch an anger float by. Actually, for me, anger doesn't float by. Desires float by. Angers float up. I don't know why. And And so there are times when I've just watched anger just float up. And I don't know if this is a good, you know, I mean, idiosyncratic, right? So I have my own words. Maybe it's not a good one for you, but sometimes I have Teflon mind, especially with anger. Just goes right by. And how much better it feels to be that way. And how much wiser I am when I'm acting from, you know, not from the anger, let it kind of go by. How much wiser I am when just not acting from desire. So it starts to see that actually, it's better not to get involved in these things. And then to have some of these things stop, to have certain desires stop and feel how good it is to have it stop and end. It's how much better it is. One of them that kind of alluded to before, earlier, that took a while to go from the time I first saw it to the time it finally felt like it faded substantially, was the desire to have everyone like me. And the desire to have everyone like you, if you have that same kind of desire as I had, guess what? It's impossible. And even more important than it's impossible, it's just not worth pursuing it. It's just not worth it. It's not cut out to be what you think it is. It's okay for people not to like you. It's completely, it's okay. It's not the end of the world. So, and it's a lot easier to go through life kind of being willing to let people not like you. I recommend it. I mean, don't go out of your way to make them dislike you now, but it's okay, it's easier. And to see that our involvement with fear abates. So in meditation, is for some people, is a very good place to see how things kind of begin to fall away, quiet down. How the usual ways in which we're driven and compulsive and caught up in things begins to quiet down. And then begin appreciating how that's nice. That's a nice thing to have that. And sometimes it becomes a source of suffering because you manage on retreat to quiet down really a lot, and it's really nice and peaceful. And then you go back and everything comes back. Your usual way of behaving comes back. And the contrast is so great that it can be disorienting and upsetting and whatever. But that's kind of normal to come back. You can't just expect to kind of stay that way, stay peaceful all the time. But you can learn from that peace. You can learn that it's possible. You can learn that it shows you a perspective which to understand better what you do that causes you to lose that peace. So start understanding ourselves more and more. And so then we start learning that that certain things that we were clinging to before, attached to before, resisting before, that it's really nice not to cling. Or we start, because we're mindful, we start seeing that we're not always clinging. We're not always suffering. We're not always caught up. We're not always resisting. And we start noticing the places where we're not and appreciating them. And in fact, the stronger the mindfulness is, the more you'll start seeing gaps, space between. It's not constant. I used to think my suffering was constant, like it's unrelenting, because it kind of felt that way because I was kind of like took the global picture of it all. But you don't take a global picture of it, but kind of get into this, the moment-to-moment experience of it. It's actually a lot of shift and changes going on. And then to see what happens in between. So here's a great exercise. I think it's great. Try to answer the question, this question. Who are you when you have no thoughts to tell you? An answer. when you don't use thoughts, who are you? So don't try to answer. But, to me, out loud. But what that does to me is that if I'm not using thoughts to answer that question, I don't have recourse to ideas and to the memories and the, plans and the hopes and all these things that I are come together with thoughts. And without those thoughts, I'm still alive. I still exist. So what's the experience of existing, of being alive, without stories and ideas and thoughts about who I am? And one of the things that I think meditation can begin to show is more and more of those spaces, those gaps of who we are when we don't tell ourselves stories, who we are when we're not involved in desires or fears, not involved in anger, and to see that that place is a refuge, that place is a place of safety, that place is a place of release and freedom. So again, this place where there's no, these gaps, these pauses and all that, can feel like it doesn't count, it's not important, it has no monetary value. It's not like a great experience. I need to have good experiences to go home and tell my friends. But it's kind of like the door is open now, and having a door open is very different than having a door locked. It's like the door open, and now you can go through. And who knows what that's waiting for on the other side. So the experience of the cessation of suffering happens in a variety of ways. So the third noble truth. It can happen in small ways, particular sufferings that we have that have been following us along for a long time, or just arose today for the first time, at some point they cease, they stop. And that stopping is actually a significant part of the practice, to notice, oh, it's gone. And now my experience is very different from what it was earlier when I was caught in that. And to appreciate that cessation, appreciate that difference. And then appreciate that it's a door that allows you to just be and let something blossom, let something else come. What comes out of that? Just like for me, compassion arose out of that. Love arose out of that open door that I didn't expect. A little bit of artistic activity came out of that door. All kinds of things arise. But it's not like I'm the one who's doing it, or planning it, or wanting it even. And it's quite a wonderful thing to go through, to have a life where I'm certainly present and kind of, I don't want to say in control, but kind of responsible for it, but then allowing something which is not my doing, that feels so right, so good, to be the primary kind of movement that comes from me, that animates me. To be able to come down to a place of freedom inside, where we're animated by the freedom, not animated by the ego, not animated by our fears or desires or cravings and angers and things like that. Animated by the heart, if you will. So this process, then, of the cessation of suffering has a lot to do with the letting go, giving up of the ways in which we are held tight, holding on. So classically it's talked about letting go of craving, but the art teacher who told me that I had no artistic ability. I had no suffering. I took on the identity that I am not an artist. I was no suffering. I had no craving that I could see or know about. It doesn't make any sense to say that I was craving, therefore I suffered. But I was locked in. I was closed down. I was held on. I lived in a fixed view. And that, and the here, what craving can be is it's locking on to a fixed view, innocently. So innocently, maybe it doesn't make sense to even call it craving, because it gives maybe the wrong impression, but it's locked in. And but, you know, as we thaw, as we relax, as we open up, and to have these things get quieter and quieter. So there's a movement where, I think, when of thinking, for example, that some of you might have the experience that sometimes your thoughts are really loud, really substantial. I have sometimes the experience that the most important, authoritative, substantial, solid thing in the universe is my thoughts, what I'm thinking about. And I'm like wedded to them. You know, they're like, you know, barreling ahead. And then as I quiet down, calm down, the thoughts become thinner and quieter. And it becomes easier as they become thinner not to be so seduced by them or caught in them. I just let them be. And it feels good to just let them be. And then it feels good sometimes to be able to let go of some of them. And some of them get thinner and thinner. And it feels better. It feels, the mind gets clear, the heart gets clear, a sense of vitality and a life arises. A sense of being alive is a wonderful thing, begins to animate us from the inside out. Rather than living from a certain kind of way from the outside in, when we live in our thinking mind and kind of relate to our life, if we come from the heart and come out, we're animated from the inside out. It can feel so good. The Buddha talked about, related a little bit like this, an underwater spring, that fountain that sprays up. So we sit here and feel this underwater source. And so we start appreciating how valuable and useful it is to let go, to quiet down, to let our thinking become thinner and weaker, not be so involved, not feed it so much. And how nice it is. It feels so good. And as we begin to let go of things more and more, let go of our past, not, you don't have to give it up completely, but as we're, at least maybe certain times, to be able to be present, fully alive and here, without involved in the past. To be able to be here, fully alive and present here, without involvement with the future. To be fully present here, without involvement with fantasy. And to feel the stillness and the quiet that comes from a mind which is not involved in those things. And then to begin to feel that even the subtle movements of being for and against, subtle movements of desire and aversion, how nice it is not to have those. And become less and less agitated, quieter and quieter, letting go, letting go. And things get thinner and thinner, quieter and quieter. The body is quiet, the mind is quiet, the heart is quiet. Quiet, kind of still, unagitated, like a very peaceful mountain lake that may be completely still surface. It's so beautiful. It feels so nice. Maybe you can so clear you can see to the bottom of the lake. So the mind gets quieter and quieter. And the movement is one towards getting thinner. The movement is one towards letting go more and more. And it's a movement that feels so right and so good that at some point, even letting go is agitating too much. And at some point, you become the placid, still mountain lake. Just a lake, just quiet. Maybe almost no thoughts, maybe no thoughts at all, seemingly. And then, the lake vanishes, disappears. And it's like the whole movement was so good, so good, so wonderful, so sublime, that the climax, the culmination of this wonderfulness is the lake disappearing. Now, I know it's hard to imagine, like, you know, what? If nothing's there, how can that be nice? Just here, just here. So this process of learning to let go of craving, clinging, of being unagitated, being equanimous, just letting things be, leads to an opening, open door, or to a springtime of our life where something has a chance to come forth that animates us, that does not have to be what we usually think our life is about. And it's a beautiful thing to let this inner animation kind of connect us to the world. And it's an inner animation which some point where the sense of inner and outer don't make sense. And the sense of love and connectedness to others becomes more and more to the forefront because of who we are. We're all family. We're all connected. We're all Sangha with each other. And to have that be part of the open heart or the liberated heart is as natural as taking your next breath. Here we are. So then to end by tying these two together, the Third Noble Truths and the Equanimity Brahmaviharas, that the Equanimity Brahmavihara is a kind of love. It's a love that does not get agitated by what is. It's the kind of love which supports realizing the Third Noble Truth. If we can have this kind of love for ourselves, to love ourselves but not be agitated by what we see or know about ourselves. Just have love. Peaceful, unagitated, settled. Allowing yourself to be just as you are, whatever thoughts, whatever difficulties, whatever challenges. Just to have that love and acceptance and be not agitated. It's okay. The wonderful mantra, wonderful profound mantra, it's okay. That's the mantra of equanimity. And then appreciating more and more as you do that, whatever little movements of cessation, of the end of suffering you have. And don't overestimate the value of even a small little, seemingly inconsequential letting go of suffering, ending of suffering. There's a teaching there. There's something to appreciate there. The release, the relief, the openness that has come, maybe. So that I can nourish you and point you to the possibility of greater and greater freedom. The freedom of the heart, not a freedom of you. May your heart be free. So let's take a minute to sit and regather.